all of whom shared that same passion for res herbaria, things to do with plants. Like the broadcasts beamed out from the first radio transmitters, the ideas that had first been debated in the Italian universities of the early 16th century spread out gradually over the rest of Europe. But this web, which so intricately connected like-minded people in mainland Europe, didn't, in William Turner's lifetime, include Britain. The universities at Oxford and Cambridge were slow to set up chairs or botanic gardens to facilitate the study of plants. The Oxford Botanic Garden, that was the first in Britain, was established 80 years after those at Pisa and Padua. And nobody in England had written a decent book on plants until Turner, the splenetic cleric, who chose to write in English. Perhaps Turner felt a kind of patriotic pride in abandoning Latin for his native tongue. Perhaps he had a vision of English as the language of scientific discourse. Perhaps he felt that if enough important books were published in English, scholars in other countries would have no option but to learn the language. It happened in the end, but Turner was ahead of his time. Produced in a foreign country in a foreign tongue, his books were never translated. He suffered the fate of many pioneers, to be forgotten. Unlucky Turner. Too soon, after he finally found himself in the right place at the right time, in England, in the 1560s, he died. And like so many pioneers, he died before the worth of what he was doing was recognised. His patient synthesising of plant names, names in Greek, Latin, English, French, German, Italian, banished much of the muddle that was bound to exist when common names were the only currency. With his wide range of contacts, Turner was responsible for stitching England into the plant map of Europe. The intellectual isolation that had marked the few English plantsmen of the first half of the 16th century had completely vanished by the second half. After Turner's death, England became a magnet for anyone interested in the study of plants. Back in 1540, Turner had fled to the continent to escape Catholic persecution. But 30 years later, and for the same reason, the great Flemish scholar Charles de Lobel, known as Lobelius, came in the opposite direction and, in terms of plantsmanship, found a country very different from the one Turner had had to leave. It was Turner who laid the foundation for the preeminence of this later generation of English plantsmen. John Goodyear, John Parkinson, John Ray. He was the vital link between the early scholar botanists and the later generation of more practical, experimental gardeners, many of whom were based here in London. But, as is the way with foundations, Turners were all too soon buried and forgotten. I do hope, though, that when Peter Turner's bust comes back here to St Olave's with all the pomp and circumstance that it deserves, someone will remember his rather more important father. This board by the church porch that lists the names of the worthies of St Olave's ought surely to include the father of English botany, the great William Turner.
And that was Anna Papewood celebrating her great gardening hero, William Turner. The producer was B.T. Rubens. Well, welcome back to the Royal Albert Hall with me, Katie Derham, and I'm welcoming back to this all-English prom here on Radio 3, the home of the BBC Proms. And if you would like to know more about this evening's programme, don't forget the notes are available on the Radio 3 website right now, and they are free. They're very, very detailed and very good, I should add. Well, in true Olympic spirit, we have the BBC National Orchestra of Wales and the BBC National Chorus of Wales, plus the BBC Symphony Chorus, all conducted by the Japanese conductor Tadaaki Otaka. With me here in the box is Adrian Partington, who's the chorus master of the National Chorus of Wales. And Adrian, you've got a very busy season because this is just the first of four concerts, isn't it?
Yes, we have. We've got two more within 2 weeks. Next Monday, we're taking part in this Bernstein extravaganza.
The Mass, the premiere of that.
The Mass, yes. Very exciting. It's an all-Welsh cast, and it's an all-Welsh young cast. It's very exciting. So we've got school children, we've got university students. And then shortly after that, we have our chief conductor's final concert. Thierry Fischer is sadly leaving us, and that is Berlioz's Grande Messe des Morts, which will involve 450 singers. And then finally, the Martyrdom of St. Sebastian by Debussy later in the month.
Very busy, but extremely worthwhile projects, all of them. And as I said earlier, in fine voice, if I may say.
Thank you.
Well, they are on stage now, but they're going to be quiet for the next 10 minutes or so, as we're going to be starting the second half of this prom with Delius and his wonderfully blissful pastoral, The Walk to Paradise Garden, an orchestral intermezzo from his opera, A Village Romeo and Juliet. It was Delius's fourth opera and tells the familiar tragic story, but in a rural mountain setting. And the walk to the Paradise Garden comes between the last two scenes. The two lovers leave rather unfriendly types at a local fair and walk to the Paradise Garden Inn, where they fall in with a group of gypsies. Midway through the interlude in the opera, the curtains part to share the lovers pausing to kiss. Well, coming to the stage now is conductor Tadaaki Otaka to conduct the BBC National Orchestra of Wales in Delius's Walk to the Paradise Garden.
Thank you.
Delius's The Walk to the Paradise Garden, performed by the BBC National Orchestra of Wales. And Adrian Partington, conductor Tadaki Ataka, has really been tugging on our heartstrings with the programme so far this evening, hasn't he? They've all these sweet lyrical pieces, marvellously performed.
They have indeed. That Delius is a truly beautiful piece. But the mood, I'm afraid, is about to change somewhat.
The volume is about to be turned up. You're absolutely right.
It certainly is. So we've all been lulled into a false sense of peace.
So loins should be girded as we're about to be, immersed?
Yes, probably.
Drenched in the work of William Walton, because we have a work now that was once described as the best choral work written for 50 years. It's William Walton's oratorio, Belshazzar's Feast. He wrote it in 1930 and 1931 and set text arranged by Osbert Sitwell from biblical sources, primarily the Book of Daniel and Psalm 137, by the Waters of Babylon. It is, as we've been suggesting, a huge piece. It has two full choruses, plus an extra brass band, in this case, London Brass. Famously, Thomas Beecham, directing the Leeds Festival where the work had its premiere, rather scathingly said, "As you'll never hear the thing again, my boy, why not throw in a couple of brass bands?" So Walton did, which makes it very, very loud indeed. Now, tonight, the brass band has been split into two, and they're actually in two boxes right up at the top of the hall, facing each other across the stage, far left and far right. Soloist tonight is baritone Jonathan Lemalu, ex-Radio 3 New Generation artist, and I asked him earlier what he felt about his role in this work.
I love the fact that it's declamatory, it's very narrative. I love the fact that not many composers will trust a singer to sing a cappella, and Walton kind of does, which is kind of cool, to his detriment. And those are the two things that I really enjoy. I love the fact that even though you have these orchestral, monumental moments, you can also have the narrator commenting, and some moments being declamatory. It seems like his personal view on the story that's going about. So that's what I enjoy about the Walton.
Talking of personal views, standing on the stage of the Proms and looking out at the Royal Albert Hall whilst having nobody supporting you, that must be quite something.
It's cool. I mean, the Albert Hall and the Proms, it's such a fixture in the world music scene. I've been lucky enough to do a few of them, and it doesn't get old. I just love the adrenaline. I love everything about Promming. It's just a great thing in London.
Jonathan Lemalu talking to me earlier about how cool it is to be singing here. Well, Adrian Partington, chorus master of the National Chorus. It isn't just about bass baritones like Jonathan, is it? It's very much a choral work.
It is
and
a choral
tough,
work.
And it's tough, isn't it?
It's very hard indeed. There's two issues, really. There's a stamina issue, particularly for the tenors and the sopranos. They have to sing lots of high, loud notes for a very long time. But worse than that is the tuning of the unaccompanied quiet bits. Walton's harmony is very sophisticated, and it's very hard to do. So my fingers are crossed.
No need to worry, I'm sure. Here comes our bass baritone, our soloist tonight, Jonathan Lemalu, and with him, the conductor, Tadaki Ataka, to conduct William Walton's Belshazzar's Feast.
Thank you. Oh, great city. Her merchandise was of gold and silver, of precious stones, of pearls, of fine linen, of purple, silk, and scarlet. All manner vessels of ivory, all manner vessels of most precious wood, of brass, iron, and marble, cinnamon, odors, and ointments, of frankincense, wine, and oil, fine flour, wheat, and beasts, sheep, horses, chariots, slaves. And the souls of Of the hand that wrote. And this was the writing that was written.
Thank you.
What a work, what a performance. Belshazzar's Feast by William Walton, performed by the BBC National Orchestra of Wales, the BBC National Chorus of Wales, the BBC Symphony Chorus, London Brass, soloist the bass baritone Jonathan Lamalu, and conductor Tadaki Otsaka. Fabulous response here in the hall, crowd on their feet. Such a brilliant work. Those snappy jazzy rhythms next to traditional choral writing. You've got massive walls of sound and then that solo voice. Wonderful, wonderful, effective writing. Well, Tadaki Otsaka and Jonathan Lamalu coming back onto the stage now to take another bow. The applause doesn't really sound like it's abating in any way, does it? Jonathan Lamalu, ex-BBC New Generation artist, joining the audience and congratulating the two choruses. So ably trained by their chorus masters, Stephen Jackson for the BBC Symphony Chorus, and my guest tonight, Adrian Partington, chorus master of the National Chorus of Wales. Well, if you've enjoyed it, you've got a chance to listen again via the website. You can also see it on BBC 4 on Thursday, the 9th of August, week on Thursday, 7:30. Don't miss that. The cameras have been in tonight, so a chance to see as well as hear that beautiful music again. I'm going to love you and leave you as the crowd here continue to cheer and stamp for the orchestras and musicians on the stage. It is time for me now, though, to hand you back to Broadcasting House and Ian Skelly.
Katie, thank you very much indeed. That was Katie Derham at the Royal Albert Hall tonight with the first of our two proms this evening. And as Katie mentioned, you can hear the prom and see it on the BBC website. You can also hear the whole prom again when we rebroadcast it a week today here on Radio 3 on Afternoon on 3, Tuesday the 7th of August. That's from 2 o'clock. Well, tomorrow night, another BBC orchestra takes to the stage at the Albert Hall, this time the BBC Symphony Orchestra, and their American principal guest conductor David Robertson will be in charge. And after that evening of English music, they're going to raise the stars and stripes tomorrow evening. Charles Ives will dominate the first half of the concert. His famous cosmic landscape, as he called it, The Unanswered Question, begins the concert. You can also hear Samuel Barber's hauntingly beautiful Adagio for Strings. And then Håkon Hardenberger will be joining the orchestra as the soloist in a spiritual-inspired trumpet concerto by Bernd Zimmermann. And to end the evening, Tippett's A Child of Our Time, the orchestra joined by the BBC Proms Youth Choir for that performance. You can hear the entire concert live here on BBC Radio 3 beginning at 7:30 tomorrow evening. Well, as I say, that was the first visit of the night to the BBC Proms. We're going to be there later this evening at 10:15 for a late-night prom, an evening of accordion music from Colombia. Radio 3's World Roots Academy apprentice, José Hernando Aria Noguera. You may have heard him on In Tune earlier this evening playing live. He'll be taking centre stage and playing very much live, together with a formidable lineup of Colombian musicians playing songs old and new from his homeland. That's at 10:15 tonight. Before then, Richard Coles will be here to embark on a global gay history, a second chance to hear his four-part series for Radio 3 on the history of same-sex desire. And in part one tonight, Richard visits Egypt, amongst other places, and a contested tomb containing two ancient Egyptian men who are thought to be either lovers or brothers. And he also comes a little closer to our own day to tell the story of a woman from the early 19th century who had same-sex relationships. But the question is, should we label her as a lesbian? The difficulties of excavating the history of homosexuality are brought out in Out in the World, a global gay history, tonight at 9:30 here on BBC Radio 3. Well, to take us to that point, music from another special festival that takes place each summer in Europe. You may have heard our live relay from Lugano in Switzerland a few weeks ago, a special festival which takes place there each and every year. It's the work of the pianist Marta Argerich, and she invites some tip-top brilliant musicians to join her on stage. And during a month-long celebration of music, she establishes all sorts of new relationships between those well-known names and up-and-coming musicians. They all come together to work together in performance. Thankfully, they also record the concerts, and the recordings are always worth revisiting. This is a recording made during their get-together in 2009, and on this occasion, Marta Argerich was joined by fellow pianist Christina Martin to play a two-piano version of Mendelssohn's incidental music to A Midsummer Night's Dream. Here's the overture, followed by the scherzo. Thank you. The Overture and Scherzo from Mendelssohn's A Midsummer Night's Dream in a live performance given at Marta Argerich's Lugano Festival in 2009. Argerich playing one of the pianos there, the other was played by Christina Martin. This is BBC Radio 3. I'm Ian Skelly here with the music at the moment as we head to the first of our four-part series, A Global Gay History, presented by Richard Coles. And that music is by Vivaldi next, a concerto for cello, a bright and sunny piece, this one. The cellist Christophe Coin is joined by Il Giordano Armonico, directed by Giovanni Antonini.
Thank you.
Cellist Christoph Kwan playing the cello concerto by Vivaldi, RV411 from the 1720s, with Il Giordano Armonico, directed by Giovanni Antonini. And that brings the time to half past nine. You're listening to BBC Radio 3. Next tonight, a chance to hear our series Out in the World, a global gay history, presented by Richard Coles, which was first broadcast last year. In his first programme tonight, which does contain some explicit historical examples, Richard explores the very real challenges of excavating homosexuality in the distant and not so distant past.
Morning rush hour, Cairo. I'm in the back of a cab and we're heading out of the centre of the contemporary city, where there's been much turmoil in the past few days with the trial of former President Hosni Mubarak happening at the police academy. It's early in the morning, but the sun is already smiting us. Smog is already hanging grey, turning brown in the sky. We're heading out towards Saqqara, which is a funeral complex that served Memphis, the capital of the Old Kingdom, 4,500 years ago. I'm in Egypt and courting controversy to look at what some say is perhaps the earliest evidence for homosexuality that exists. It's where this series begins, and it's also where it ends, for not far from the site of ancient tombs in the desert is Tahrir Square, rallying point for the Egyptian revolution. It's too early to say what will emerge from it. A democratic pluralist state on the Western model, or an Islamic Republic offering a very different version of modernity. It's a critical moment for the entire nation, not least for the country's gays and lesbians, as Mustafa Fati knows well. He's the author of Egypt's first gay novel, and I thought we were courting controversy.
When I wrote my book, a lot of media talk, I have an agenda from America. We have to kill this writer. There is no homosexuality in our society. It's not true. In the revolution, the Egyptian revolution, there is a lot of gays in El Tahrir Square. You know, I know them, and I saw a lot of gays in El Tahrir Square. And that means something very important. They are Egyptian.
Interesting that for Mustafa, the presence of gay men and women in Tahrir Square during those crucial days writes them into history. But then gay activists and fellow travellers tend to have a feeling for history. Evidence for the existence of gay people at all times and in all places helps the effort to achieve equal rights. But defining, let alone uncovering gay history, if I can put it like that, is highly problematic. Theme of our first programme and my visit to the historic site of Saqqara. We've driven about an hour out of Cairo. To my right, there's palm trees and green.
then to my left on the other side of the road, there's just a rising slope of rock and sand. So then all of a sudden these huge structures, there's a stepped pyramid that has just risen up in front of us, and then tomb openings which are cut into the light sandy coloured rock. Here we go to pull it and park.
The step pyramid of King Unas, the last king of the 5th dynasty, is surrounded by the tombs of high-ranking officials of the royal court, and I'm here to visit one in particular. We're well off the tourist beat. No one's asked me to ride their camel for at least an hour. It seems that even the Egyptians know little of this place. My guide is Dr. Ramadan Hussein, head of documentation in Egypt's Supreme Council of Antiquities.
We're standing in a sort of depression, you know, and there's a cut through the landscape here in Saqqara. It's like a kind of grand causeway, would you call it that?
It's a causeway, yeah.
It's a causeway, and that's cut off, and it would have passed over. I mean, it's broken now, but right in the middle of that break, there's a massive structure, almost a kind of military bunker made of massive stone. And this, Ramadan, is the tomb that we've come to see.
Yep. It's the tomb of Nianknum and Khnumhotep.
So we go down some steps now. Impossible not to feel like Lord Carnarvon on such occasions, isn't it? Mm. And when was the tomb excavated, Ramadan?
It was excavated in 1964, and it was actually found in a very ruined state, and some of the blocks were found away from the tomb, reused in the causeway of King Unas. So clearly the tomb in antiquity has been demolished completely.
I'm about to enter a very unusual mastaba. Unusual because it was built for two men. Some say it's a monument to a gay relationship.
Oh, look at this. Wonderful. There's a narrow entrance and there's a sort of vestibule here. And it's faced with stone, which is covered with relief carving. It's fantastic. Beautiful stuff. The quality is wonderful. We have a fisherman here who speared some fish.
And the fisherman here is actually one of the tomb owners, Nianknum and Khnumhotep. The most important of all the themes is what we're looking at right this minute, which is the tomb owner is spearing two tilapia fishes, killing evil that is embodied into these tilapia fishes. Because in Egyptian theology, the tilapia fish is a representation of evil. And one of these important things that every tomb owner had to perform in the afterlife is maintaining cosmic order.
Carvings on either side, a heavy lintel. Let me move through that to... It's actually a complex of rooms.
It's a multi-chamber tomb that we usually call it in Egyptological literature, mastaba, which is composed of two structures, the superstructure where you have all these multiple chambers with the reliefs on the walls, and then a substructure where you have a huge shaft that leads into the burial chamber.
About 12 feet high, all the walls covered with bands of extraordinary vivid decoration. Beautiful carved reliefs, and also quite a lot of the colour has survived quite well.
Everything in the tomb is really fitting very well with the decorum that has been set for the decorative program of the Old Kingdom tombs. Nothing is unusual in the tomb, except that we're dealing with two men here.
They're holding hands, two male figures holding hands.
Right.
Would that be very unusual?
It's very unusual, because this particular pose is reserved to the wife of the deceased. The deceased and his wife. We don't have any other tomb than actually we have two men sharing the same tomb and also allowing themselves to be represented in this very close physical context. So we're actually facing some intriguing scenes that we have to think about them. It's very open for several interpretation.
What do the hieroglyphics tell us?
Well, the hieroglyphics, one of the things is also important with this scene that you see the deceased with his wife, his family members, either the daughters or the sons.
So let's be clear about this. This is someone who is married.
Who's married.
And a father.
And a father. The very fact that we have two people, two male, buried in this tomb, has his own wife and children, it makes it also problematic to think about the relation between these two.
And then we go through here from the right, and then into a sort of open courtyard. And then to the left of it, there's another kind of massive doorway, steps up. Then we move into a dramatically darker space. It's lit now with fluorescent tubes, which could enable you to see the reliefs more clearly. And in the centre of it, on the pillar, between the two doors that lead in, we have perhaps the most striking relief in the whole complex. We've got the two figures here, and they're actually touching nose to nose.
Yeah.
I mean, it's as near to a kiss as you can get.
This is actually how kiss is being represented in Egyptian art.
And so the figure on the right has his arm around the shoulder of the figure. I mean, they're actually kind of drawn together, drawing each other together.
Yeah.
And it's just this tiny distance separating one nose from the other.
Yeah. I mean, it's very delicate relief.
Would it be too much to construe from that that there is a particular character of intimacy, unusually for a male pair being shown here? Or would that be just to kind of go too far?
Well, I wouldn't say we go too far. It's very intriguing to see something like that. We haven't seen it before in Nyankhnum and Khnumhotep. This physical intimacy is very reserved for the man and wife in a representation. But we're seeing here now between two men. Are we dealing with two gay lovers? We might be. Are we not? That is a possibility as well.
It's stunning.
It's beautiful.
I've never been in an ancient Egyptian tomb before.
It is amazing. I mean,
very tempting to think that I'm looking at an image of two lovers, but many Egyptologists look at it quite differently.
I don't think it's completely out of the question, but it does seem to me to be the least likely way to understand it.
Professor John Baines of Oxford University has written about the tomb.
I suggested that this was an elaborate presentation of two men who were twins, and because they are twin brothers, and the category of being a twin was suppressed, as it were, socially, they had to have an altogether exceptional treatment in order to be viable for owning a monument, and probably for their roles in life. And so I think they are essentially shown as if they were a single person, because there is some sort of taboo surrounding twin status, and it has to be addressed in some way.
A good lesson in the historiography of homosexuality. Two men depicted holding hands and kissing, however intimate it might appear, is not necessarily a depiction of homosexuality. We see what we want to see? Maybe. But isn't that true of all interpreters?
The whole process of recovering ancient societies is one of interpretation. And the number of facts that we have is very limited. So if we are going to look at a tomb like this one, then we need to immerse ourselves in the material of the period, and that tells you about a world of discourse and presentation, and it doesn't tell you directly about how people led their lives. So if either of these men had boyfriends, this is something that is conceivable, but I have no evidence either way. We simply can't get at all easily beyond the monument to the lives that people led.
You only have to look back to painting in the 19th century to be surprised by what our ancestors found erotic. Dr. Richard Parkinson looks back much further than that. His assistant keeper of ancient Egyptian pharaonic culture at the British Museum.
We have a papyrus which shows the naked god of the earth, Geb, curling over and sucking himself off. And to us, this looks like a piece of pornography. It's in a religious papyrus, buried with a priestess. It's extremely formal religious art. And clearly, the scene is meant to show that the earth is marvelous in its self-sustaining fecundity. But to us, it looks very much like a bit of pornography. But then you wonder whether people could possibly look at such symbolism without seeing it as something sexual. It's very, very hard to get that balance right between how it was meant to be seen, how the ancients saw it, and how we see it.
The key problem here is that the word homosexuality and the concept that goes with it goes back only 100 years or so, as we will discover. And it's very much a Western idea. Trying to apply it to the ancients or to cultures contemporary with but different from our own is tricky.
I think the main difficulty in constructing a history of homosexuality is ourselves and our preconceptions and our assumptions.
Dr. Matt Holbrook of Oxford University.
We inhabit this contemporary world where there's a pervasive and powerful assumption that we have a sexuality. We have a sexuality that's often the core of our personal being and forms the core of our personal identity. And in attempting to write the history of sexuality, in effect, we're projecting that assumption, that understanding back onto the past.
What's difficult about doing the history of sexuality is that we are operating with a framework of knowing the sexual that we inherited from the late 19th century and early 20th centuries. That's our frame.
Professor Laura Dode of Manchester University.
That frame determines the way that we can think about the sexual past, but it also constrains how we're able to historicize. So the challenge for the historian of sexuality is to be able to stand back and actually see that frame, try to work with it, but also try to break it apart and work outside of it.
We encounter this idea in the work of the French philosopher and critic Michel Foucault, Professor Chris Waters of Williams College in Massachusetts.
Foucault argued in many ways that we have to look at the difference between sexual behavior and sexual identity. Sexual identity, homosexual identity in particular, is a very recent phenomenon. While we have homosexual behavior before the 1880s, 1890s, we don't have sexual identities. We don't have individuals who conceive of themselves as a unique type of being, a species of being. And therefore, we have to study how that transformation comes about. And it's a story that a lot of people have challenged. A lot of people argue that there's no watertight division between the pre-late 19th century and the post-late 19th century, that to speak in terms of practices here and identities there creates an arbitrary divide that just can't exist. And while there's a lot of questioning of the model, it's in many ways informed not only debates amongst historians, but the kind of work that historians do.
Doors open. Third floor.
We're being buzzed through the security doors at the Wellcome Institute that lead to the Wellcome Library, which is one of the biggest collections of this kind of material anywhere. Is this where
this
we need
is
to
the
be?
Viewing rooms.
Oh, excellent.
Okay. Medical historians from all over the world beat a path to its door. And in its archive, many of the pioneering works of the 19th century sexologists may be found, some of them crucial to the evolution in our time of the understanding of homosexuality.
Morning.
Morning. This is Leslie.
Hello, Leslie. Richard Coles.
I'm here to meet senior archivist Leslie Hall.
Mrs. Craft Ebbing in here.
Mrs. Craft Ebbing here. I got out a small selection from the collection, which
among the Wellcome Library's treasures are the complete papers of Richard von Craft Ebbing.
We've got his case notes.
Oh, look at this.
Mostly in German and in this really rather impenetrable late 19th century Germanic handwriting.
Craft Ebbing was one of the earliest and most important sexologists.
Possibly the first medical man who ventilated the subject outside medical societies discussing odd cases they'd come across, because earlier in the century, and indeed well into the 20th, if you look in medical manuals, the only discussion of sex between men is how you discover the evidence for sodomitic practices.
So that would be leading to a sort of forensic purpose?
Yes, it's because obviously in most European countries, sex between men, quote-unquote sodomy, was criminalised. It wasn't in France, but in Germany, in the Netherlands, in the UK.
But Craft Ebbing was doing something different. He was trying to capture information or look at the phenomenon from a different point of view.
He was trying to understand it. He wasn't just trying to say, oh my God, this is like weird, or, you know, this is like, let's condemn these people, let's bang them up in madhouses.
In 1886, he published Psychopathia Sexualis, an attempt to list the range of sexualities he'd come across in his case studies, many of which were sent in by homosexual people themselves.
You see the note he's put on there, psychically hermaphroditic, and one of the ways he was trying to understand, or people were trying to understand homosexuality, was through the idea of a kind of internal hermaphroditism, that, you know, it was like the soul of a woman in the body of the man, and vice versa, of course, in the case of lesbians.
Trying to understand the nature of same-sex desire by
saying, you know, they're actually a blend of the two sexes in some way. I must just show you this because it's in terms of, you know, people sending things to Craft Ebbing.
Oh, look at this.
Look at that. It's a chap in a corset.
It's a photograph, presumably from 1890s, around that
Yeah,
period.
Around about 1890s. I'm not sure we have an exact date.
And it's very obviously a man, but a man dressed in a corset. He's got stockings, high-heeled shoes. He's showing a lot of bum and a lot of thigh. And his I think it's either a wig or it's a very kind of boofy hairdo.
Yeah.
And he's standing there holding a fan with elbow-length gloves and looking at the camera in a slightly imploring way. Understand me.
Yes.
Oh, look here.
Yes, we've got a set. We've also got the one in him sort of as a female Greek dancer type person.
They look slightly made complex by him wearing a moustache.
Yes. Yeah. It's. I mean, at this point, I don't think the people who are thinking about the subject have kind of teased out the differences between homosexuality, transvestism, and what we might now think of as an actual trans identity.
So that's happening in Germany. At what point does this kind of research begin to make an impact in Britain?
Well, there is already interest happening in the UK. For example, John Addington Symonds, who is kind of an early, as it were, homophile campaigner in the UK, he published a book called A Problem in Greek Ethics in the 1880s.
So what is the problem in Greek
ethics? The problem in Greek ethics is the fact that you know, they are regarded as, you know, the founding fathers of modern civilization, and all they had the virtue, civics, you know, philosophy, foundations of modern science, etc., etc. And yet, you know, they saw nothing wrong with this practice that is regarded as criminal, degraded, sinful, and bestial in Victorian England.
Symonds collaborated with the physician and psychologist Henry Havelock Ellis to write Sexual Inversion, the first English medical textbook on homosexuality.
This is the actual original version, and he says, and I think this is very nice, "I found in time that several persons for whom I felt respect and admiration were the congenital subjects of this abnormality. And at the same time, I realised that in England, more than in any other country, the law and public opinion combined to place a heavy penal burden and a severe social stigma on the manifestation of an instinct which, to those persons who possess it, frequently appears natural and normal. It was clear that the matter was in special need of elucidation and discussion." And they've just completed it, and Symonds dies. Symonds had TB. He was living in Switzerland for his TB, and he dies at a relatively young age. And his executors go, "Mr. Ellis, we feel that the family would not be happy with having Mr. Symonds' name associated with this book. Could you take his name off? And by the way, could you rewrite it entirely to make sure there is nothing that anybody could pick up that he had anything to do with it whatsoever?" So it's very rare to have this edition which actually has Ellis's and Symonds' name, because the executors really went round buying it up and destroying it.
Would it be fair to say that we're seeing something coming into focus?
Yes, I think it's absolutely true that there is this sense that certain things have been kind of swirling around in a somewhat inchoate way, trying to find ways of understanding it that aren't just about saying these people are degraded criminals, or these are evil sinners who need to repent and reform. Why do people do this?
In a sense, Leslie, we could call these foundational documents in terms of a kind of scientific attempt to understand.
Oh, yes, in terms of understanding, these are, I think, foundational documents. Yeah.
In Havelock Ellis's view, sexual inversion is an innate condition, the view of many today in one form or another, and an important argument in the battle for legal reform. But it was challenged by Freud and some of his followers, who gave a contrasting account. Professor Chris Waters of Williams College in Massachusetts.
A very different kind of story, a developmental story, a story of the development of forms of behaviour, a deviation from the norm due to family circumstances and upbringing, which is very much in conflict with the notions of innate inversion that Havelock Ellis puts forward. And in the 1920s and the 1930s, particularly the latter decade, there's a lot of sort of battles between people in one camp or in the other.
The sexologists were influential primarily in Europe, but across the Atlantic, Freud's ideas gained ground.
In the United States, there is a lot more money put into treatment of homosexuality, and the notion that if this is a psychosexual aberration, mapped in Freudian terms, then we can correct the anomaly. And therefore, treatment centres, psychiatrists who are willing to treat homosexuals and prefer cures for homosexuality, that practice is much more widespread in the United States.
And then two large volumes here, Leslie, with Hirschfeld.
Yes, these are Magnus Hirschfeld, published 1920. This is the period when he's setting up his Institute for Sexueller Wissenschaft in Berlin.
Sexual wisdom.
Yeah, sexual knowledge, wisdom, learning. And he's very dedicated, both investigator of homosexuality, and he's very active in the campaign to reform the German penal code.
This is
his huge, thick volume.
It's interesting that the law at this time was exclusively interested in male homosexuality.
Oh, yes, it wasn't.
And is that reflected too in the work of people like Simmons and Krafft Ebing? Are they interested in female homosexuality?
They do mention female homosexuality, but there are far fewer cases. This is partly because, in the case of Krafft Ebing, he's seeing people who can afford to consult him. So therefore, you know, you have probably got far more men who are able to consult an elite psychiatrist than women. And as it wasn't illegal for women, it is not quite such a critical thing anyway. Women are often, there tends to be a perception that women can have beautiful and devoted friendships, particularly if they're not going to marry anyway. You often get women setting up households together. But it can't possibly be about sex because, you know, women don't have desire, or at least they only have desire if they have a husband and their husband, as it were, awakens it.
So the sexologists really framed our modern understanding of homosexuality by giving us the language. There are, however, compelling examples which predate the language.